to entertain you. We'll sing your songs.
Hey there. Are you obsessed with things that happened before your time? Well, if you are, join me, the host of Before My Time, Gelsey Lori, to discuss the wonders of the yesteryears that we weren't around to enjoy ourselves. You can find us on all podcast platforms.
Dixieland's a playing, soon you'll be swaying, so come on, sing along.
We're making an ad.
Napping ad.
This is where I think if we're doing it right, Alec Baldwin comes in. He says a couple things. Mm-hmm. He listens to the podcast every week. Yep. Has he been canceled? Was Alec Baldwin the one who killed somebody? I hear that Gary Sinise is free.
Oh, okay, great.
He hasn't worked since 2020.
So what would be the script that we would have Gary Sinise say for the Napping Through Happy Hour podcast?
Listen to this damn show. Damn it.
The Napping Through Happy Hour podcast brought to you by Geekscape.
Real life, real drama, real time.
I'm Gary Sinise.
That's the ad. That's the ad.
Welcome to another episode of Horror Movie Night. This week, we are talking about It Follows from 2014, celebrating a 10-year anniversary this year. And I'm pretty sure this was your pick, Scott?
Yes, it was.
I am interested to dive into this because this was only the second time I've ever watched this movie.
This is my first.
Oh, okay.
Like, this was a blind watch.
That's even more interesting to me. Kyle, how many watches has this been for you? Because I feel like this was like probably something you had watched a couple times.
Yeah, this is about four. This is about my fourth watch.
Nice.
I'm very eager to hear what you both think, but I'm just going to throw out there briefly and quickly, like, this keeps climbing rank for me as far as like top horror films go in my world. And all of the comparisons and stuff that have been made previously, and especially at the time of the film's release, have sort of like dripped away, and it exists on its own for me now, which is a beautiful thing that a film can like
rise above.
Rise above the things
to know
that like
what the comparisons were back then, because I don't like this movie was like everywhere was talking about it, and like a fucking dipshit I was like, this doesn't interest me, I'm not gonna watch it, and I just had no interest
there.
Like, you know what the gateway for this was Disaster Piece's soundtrack for it. I heard the main theme, I was like, this is fucking great. I bought it on his Bandcamp, and then I found a copy at some record store, and I bought it, and it's just, it's so good. It's up there with like the Maniac 2012,
and that's high praise because you love that soundtrack.
And I'm trying. Yeah. Rob was the composer for that, and it's very interesting because they are coming at it in a very similar way, which is kind of like this. It's like a movie out of time and also a soundtrack out of time. It's very 80s inspired.
I did write that down, that we have this scene pretty early on in the movie where they're watching the 50s movie Killers from Space. They're reading on like a weird Kindle app that I don't think has ever existed
in the shape
before.
Of a seashell.
Right? Like, yeah. In a seashell. The wallpaper's like super 70s, but their clothing is like very 90s. Like, it found this really interesting way of setting a super ambiguous time period, like, instantaneously, which
and
I do like about that.
There's a fan theory that we'll get into about all that. But Kyle, I'm so sorry for getting sidetracked.
No, please.
When this movie came out 10 years ago, what were they likening it to?
I mean, I think there was a ton of Carpenter comparison, and both in like the how it was like more, and I wouldn't say how it was shot, but more in like the framing of everything and the buildup. Obviously, you know, a lot
pacing
of
pacing definitely makes sense.
Pacing, a lot of Halloween reference. You know, Michael Myers type like thing coming. You know, like this slow but not dumb.
There was a lot of like 80s pastiche happening all at the same time, because I think that this was around the same time that the first season of Stranger Things hits. So it's like there's just like this vibe that it's being compared to. I'm probably, based on the conversation that we're already having, the person who is the least into this movie.
Get out.
I wrote two different, well, let me read the two different notes that I wrote, because the first one I wrote very early on and the second one I wrote about halfway through the movie. And the first note I wrote said that this film has one of the most perfectly executed opening sequences of all time, almost to the detriment of the rest of the movie for me. I think that opening scene with Anne running through the street, and it's this single take and then jump cut to like a mutilated corpse on the beach, is terrifying. Yeah. The other note that I wrote, this is probably the biggest film that I'm like wildly impressed by while still not into. Like, I think that the camera work, the music, the performances, the originality, like all of it is top tier, and yet I feel super bored half the time when I watch it. And I am aware that I am like the minority in this. Like, I know that this is like one of the most easily in the top 10 most beloved horror films of the last decade. Like, celebrating its 10-year anniversary, I still think that if someone was to make their list of the 10 best horror films from 2014 to 2023, that It Follows would still be on that list for most people. And I would be like, hell yeah, absolutely, it should be there, while simultaneously being like, but it's just not a movie I ever want to watch. Like, it's not for me.
That, so much of that is pacing. You know, it's really, it's a dread. The movie is dread because, and I think that's important for the entity, for the follower, because the follower doesn't give a fuck about what you want pacing wise. It just walks. And I mean, we'll get into the thing that I loved so much about, because this movie was more of an experience than a watch for me, because like I'm watching it and the lore is just, or like, you guys know Daddy loves some SCP Foundation. So this is like straight up an entity that would have been in containment in some SCP story. And actually, like, there is a similar entity that I want to talk about later.
What are you talking about? What is the thing that you're referencing?
Oh, I've talked about SCP so many times. Have I never explained what it is?
You might have.
I don't think Kyle has been here when we talked about it. I think that was a lot of Brian episodes.
Okay, so the SCP Foundation is basically like a wiki. It's like it's a collection of these shorts, like a collective of short stories that get built upon, and they're all horror related. Like horror, it's kind of like Twilight Zone, but a lot of it is so it's secure, contain, protect, SCP. And there is like, so it's this shadow government and outside of the government.
X-Files is probably the better comparison.
Oh, maybe it's more X-Files.
It's more X-Files in the fact that it's an anthology series about the agency that is protecting us from creatures.
Yeah, but there's like all these creatures, and they have different levels of there are different threat levels. There's like and they're named after I want to say angels, something like that, but there's like, there are ones that are just small time, they'll kill a person. There are ones that will not kill anyone. They have like threat levels like neutralized, if they've been able to neutralize. A lot of it is containment, because they cannot destroy these creatures, because there's a lot of dead man switches, where if they kill a creature, there is some sort of like cataclysmic world ending, world destroying, or like reality unraveling type thing.
Oh, cool.
There are like orbs, like kind of cursed objects throughout it. It's not just Monster of the Week type stuff. There's these recurring characters. There are some scientists and people that are on the extra military teams that go out and catch or re-catch the creatures. And then there are D-class, who are detainees, who are usually like food or test subjects to see what the awful effects that these creatures do to them. But that was like my favorite way to unwind when I was waiting at work for something to run. You know, like if I was waiting for some process to finish, I was like, oh, I'll go read an SCP. Because some of them are, you know, can take a minute. Some of them can take 10 minutes. Some of them are these longer stories that just take like days to get through because you have, because they're like cross-referenced with other creatures, and it's super, super cool. Highly recommend it to anybody that likes horror, because also they're rated and edited by multiple people in the collective, and so they're like they're better than one person writing all this, but very Lovecraftian, very like lots of cosmic horror.
I'm almost thinking that, Scott, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to promote the Patreon real quick.
Ooh.
I actually think that your next Patreon episode should be telling Kyle and I like your top five.
I've had that on my to-do list for forever, but
I think it's time. I think that that's what I
think about the follower as like an SCP.
That makes a lot of sense. Like, that absolutely makes a lot of sense, because there is, it's this just dropped in real world reality thing that we're dealing with, and that so there is a knowledge of how to deal with it, but there's really no clear way of how to deal with it.
And the question is like, where did it come from? And and you know, it's really interesting. So the entity that that comes to mind is SCP-096. Now, that entity is kind of like a, it's an emaciated humanoid. I believe that it is kind of sexless, but it has like extremely long.
Oh, well, then it's not this, because this thing's got titties. I've seen them.
Lots of boobs in this movie, and none of them are good. But I think that's what's so great. I love the follower. The follower, like, just the fucking lore of this creature is incredible to me, because it leaves enough to the imagination while also being incredibly graphic about what it does to you. Now, we'll talk about Greg's death, because that, to me, I love that, that, you know, like, Matt comes out the gate here like, you know, I appreciate this movie for what it does, but at the same time, nothing tops that intro scene. Greg's death, man, it was...
Well, that's a different type of topping.
I could not believe that they went... Yeah, oh, shit. Wow. But I could not believe that they went there. But anyway,
yes, no,
so it's you know, like,
it's got its, like, don't get me wrong, there are scenes, like a scene that I think is, in my mind, I think a scene that is great, and then I kind of lose interest almost instantaneously, is the scene where they're on the beach.
Oh, yeah.
And it cuts to that shot, and you see a girl walking in the distance, and then it cuts to the friend, and then it cuts back, and the girl's not there, and I'm like, that's brilliant. But then I think my biggest problem with It Follows is anytime that it does, for a lack of a better term, like invisible man shit. And I, and I'm like, God, the invisible man stuff doesn't work for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because maybe I've been pampered that like a couple years later, we got the 2020 version of the invisible man,
with,
which I think is like
Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah. And it's, that to me is like one of the greatest, because I think doing any Invisible Man movie is already a tough sell. We've done Hollow Man here. We know how rough it can get.
Invisible Mania.
Now, that's how good it can get.
That's right.
And it's right. It's Invisible Maniac 2020. Invisible Man.
That's everywhere. Real high.
They're right there. I mean, but yeah, it's like those moments that just like don't. I don't want to say they take me out of the movie, but I'm just like, man. And then when they're hiding in the shack and shooting at the creature walking, I'm like, okay, I'm back.
See, the shooting doesn't do it for me.
No, the shoot. I mean, look, the idea that they can shoot this thing is kind of dumb to me in general. And I really, I wrote this down too, where I said, I always feel like the pool set piece is one of the most underwhelming endings to this movie. Like, just her in the pool, the creature throwing the electronic devices in the pool, and it not doing what their plan was in the first place, and then they like essentially shoot it in the head, and do they kill it or not? Who knows? I mean, obviously, we're getting a sequel this year, and it's very implied in the final shot that they didn't kill it, but it is one of those things where I'm just like, why would you think that that worked?
Yeah.
Well, I think that that's the whole point, is that they're out of ideas, and then they come up. It's also, this is a huge homage to 80s Kids Save the Day movies.
That,
and
the
what
kids,
did
kid
they
logic.
Do? It's kid logic. And, you know, the dreamlike quality is something that I felt a lot. And then I was reading some theories, and it's kind of like they're in limbo.
Yeah.
That they don't actually, they're not, this isn't actually happening in the real world, because like you don't see any parents. And the only parents you see, like, I think you see
Greg's mom, obviously, but that's about Greg's mom.
Well, but you see Greg, you only see Greg's mom before she kills him.
Yes.
You see for a second, you see her twice. What's the first guy? The guy that gives it to
Jeff Raymond. You see Jeff Raymond.
You see Jeff's mom twice, because she's the follower. She's in the shape of the follower as he's, you know, kind of doing the exposition about the entity. And then you see her again when they find his real house.
And that was the first time I caught that, actually, which was interesting. Like, I didn't fully get that. And then I remember he said that there's that, like, they sometimes come in somebody that you love to try to, like, trick you, right? Like,
yeah.
But the thing is that every time you see a death blow, I hate to say that term, anytime you see the follower about to make a kill or making a kill, it's always the parent, the opposite sex of the kid that's being attacked. Annie at the beginning, she is running away from her dad, and then she calls her dad on the phone and saying, I'm so sorry, I love you and mom, all that. So to me, it's heavily implied that the follower comes to her in the shape of her dad. To me, is pretty obvious that it's written as the follower's final form, more or less, is your parent of your opposite sex. That's all we see here. But that's the only time we see parents in this movie.
That's true. Something that I do think, unless I'm misinterpreting things that happen in this movie, when Jay gets this passed to her, for all of the negative things that we say about, that you can say about Hugh/Jeff in this movie, the person who gives this disease to Jay, this creature to Jay, he runs down all the rules. He runs down how to protect yourself. He's given the audience exposition. He's providing Jay exposition. It seems like there are multiple scenes in this movie where the implication is that Jay or even Paul goes and has sex with somebody else pass it on, but they don't explain the rules, because that quickly the creature is following them again. You know what I mean? Like, she swims out to that pool, she swims out to that boat with guys, and then they still have to kill the creature a day or so later, because she's probably not being thorough the way that Hugh was, of saying, like, you have to be on the constant move, you have to, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, there's so many things that you have to do to even buy yourself some extra time. Yeah. And she's simply not doing it.
He was dating her. He was dating Jay. So he definitely liked her. Mm-hmm. And Jay does things that she definitely doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
To survive. And so I think that there is, like those three dudes on the boat, she's doing something that she doesn't want to do to... Yeah. Buy herself some time. If I were in the same position, would I tell them? I mean, yeah, it would. You'd want to explain it, but you don't have the time. You know, like,
yeah.
There's no relationship there.
Jeff was like very clear, where he's like, "Look, you got to keep moving. You got to keep doing whatever it takes, because if this thing fucking thing gets to you, it's coming right back to me next."
Well, so that's the strategy, though, that I think, and like, that's, again, there's a little bit of kid logic that works here. Like, when you do something that tries to get you out of trouble, and you like sort of pin it on another person, right? Yep. There's like this, there's this very like trying to be mature, but you're still a child thing that happens. So then Jay choosing not to tell them is a strategy, but it doesn't buy her necessarily more time. But what's gonna be worse, trying to then defend yourself to, you know, the guys on the boat, or to just run and just hope that they can figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
Speaking of kid logic, There's so many nondescript sodas in this movie that I just got a Dr. Pepper. Everybody's drinking soda.
And I made a sex on the beach.
Yes!
I don't even like orange juice.
Madman.
That's in a couple weeks, buddy.
oops, spoiler.
Oh, that's... That's terrible. Why would you ever order this? Oh my God.
Well, let me tell you the rules to Sex on a Beach.
I think it's funny that the director, the writer and director of this movie, David Robert Mitchell, has said that, like, he basically couldn't show the movie, like, show the script to anyone until it was done, because he realized while he was reading it that, like, there's no way to explain this movie that doesn't sound like the worst film idea in the world.
Yeah. Like, dude, a million percent.
He's like, I had to just have a finished script to hand them to,
you
like,
know?
Cause, like,
there's no elevator pitch for this.
No, exactly, because it's like your elevator pitch. You know who's going to get real excited about the movie pitch of a killer STD? Lloyd
Incels.
Kaufman. Oh, like, you're going to be making a trauma movie.
That's a horseshoe right there.
Yeah, it's walking. You're walking a very fine line here.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Oh,
maybe,
God.
Maybe it's, you know, as thin as a pube.
Maybe, Scott.
So here's a question also. Mm-hmm. Do you have to have unprotected sex to pass on the entity, to pass on the follower?
Well,
or
so
can
that,
you use a condom?
I because of the ambiguity of the timeline of it, it makes, and everything's sort of like stripped down, for lack of a better term.
Yeah,
I imagine that, like, this idea of contraception or safe sex doesn't really exist in this world. I mean, there's this feels like a weird alternate universe that doesn't have this sort of, like, you know, because we don't say sex at all in this.
No.
If
yeah.
I remember correctly, we don't say the word sex at all.
I
don't think that they say, like, really anything. It's just passing it on, right? Or giving it mm-hmm. to somebody else. Like, it's all of this stuff. So, like,
that's kid logic, though. I love that you brought that up, because, like, it makes so much sense that all the decisions that they make and the way that they view their fucking terrible situation mm-hmm. and is like, oh, let's go drink on a beach. I really loved the casting, because when you watch so many horror movies where they're supposed to be in high school, they're always 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Jay is supposed to be taking college courses, and she goes and she's drinking, I believe, a margarita with Jeff, Hugh, whatever you want to call him. So I believe that they are 21 or older, but the casting, she looks so young.
Yeah.
That I really found that to be very, very off-putting in a certain mm-hmm. way, but also I found that very interesting, because it feels like when I look at college students, because, like, I live in a college town. If I ever drive through campus, I'm like, they look so young. They look like, did I look like that when I was in college?
Yeah.
Did I look like that when I was finally able to buy myself a six pack of beer? I guess, but at the same time, it's like, when you're that age, you look like you feel like the right age, but also it's just this kind of infantilization of all these characters, and so. Kind of, there are no good people in this movie, which is very interesting. Like, they're all kind of bad, but they're bad in, like, an immature way. There's no, like, they're not actually malicious. They're just trying to get themselves out of trouble, like you said.
Well, it's also, I mean, most of them are still not known names, but the mm-hmm, fact that in 2014 it was, like, you just buy them as kids, because they're, which is impressive. It's impressive that this movie was as big and successful as it was with, like, no huge name in front of it, basically a first-time director. I mean, it's his second movie, but, like, no one saw his $50,000 Sundance film. You know what I mean? Like, everyone's starting out fresh from scratch, and it became, like, a huge thing. Like, this movie was made for $1.3 million and made $23.3 million. Like, that's
wild.
Nothing to be ashamed of mm-hmm. for a first-time, like, essentially a first-time director with a completely original script based on no previous source material and no big-name star to promote it. That was just strictly, like, word of mouth. I'd say, like, arguably maybe the most famous person in the movie is, like, and it's only because I'm a weirdo, is the actor who played Paul was the star of Atypical, which is, like, the most critically acclaimed but nobody watched Netflix show. I don't know. There's, like I said, there's a lot
I vaguely
to love.
Remember Atypical.
Yeah.
I only know about it because of Matt.
Like I said, there's a lot to love in this movie, and I do think it's a great movie. Like, when I was watching it, I was like, I wish I liked this movie more, because there's so much to love about
it. It's definitely a cinematographer's movie, though. Yeah. You know, like, it's a very art school movie, and I don't say that in a mean way. Like, sometimes I definitely shit talk what we discuss on here for that same reason, but if it's done with love and it's done with, like, there's nothing wrong with being technically proficient as long as you're not bashing the viewer over the head with your technical proficiency.
Yeah.
And like, for a pretty minimalist horror movie, the wide shots really work for me. And there are some cool in-camera things that they do with moving the camera.
Yeah, like, there's a scene where they walk into the school and the camera almost does, like, a full spin to the exit. And it's, like, it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's, like, all they're doing is just turning a camera. But, like, it looks, whatever they're doing with the way that the camera's moving, it feels.
Yeah.
I mean, he said that he wanted the movie to feel like a dream. And, like, it has that exact effect of, like, turning in a dream where it feels like slightly off.
Everything feels slightly off in this, and it's what makes it so dread inducing.
Well, it's so consistent too. There's not, like you're saying, Scott, there's nothing that we're getting bashed over the head with. Like, everything really has purpose and consistency to all those movements or all that framing, or, you know, and this, I mean, we're also talking about, like, this is a few years after the Safdie brothers have really, like, they haven't done Uncut Gems yet, but they're sort of stirring in this, like, New York City, like, film scene and doing things like this, these long shots and watching scenes from far away and doing all this stuff, which is not clear. You know, they're not the proprietors of that, but they certainly have made it more popular in the past 10 years, you know, 10, 15 years. So seeing stuff like that applied to horror is really fun. You know, I think Jeremy Saulnier does some of that stuff in True Detective, like, not to that extent, but then at the same time, the Safdie brothers can be so annoying with this. Like, they can just, like, slam you with it. And I just think this has a very light hand, and which is great for horror, because it could be far more annoying than it is.
We're here to entertain you. We'll sing your songs.
Hey there. Are you obsessed with things that happened before your time? Well, if you are, join me, the host of Before My Time, Gelsey Laurie, to discuss the wonders of the yesteryears that we weren't around to enjoy ourselves. You can find us on all podcast platforms.
Soon you'll be swaying, so come on, sing along.
We're making an ad.
Napping ad.
This is where I think, if we're doing it right, Alec Baldwin comes in. He says a couple things. Mm-hmm. He listens to the podcast every week. Yep. Has he been canceled? Was Alec Baldwin the one who killed somebody? I hear that Gary Sinise is free.
Oh, okay, great.
He hasn't worked since 2020.
So, what would be the script that we would have Gary Sinise say for the Napping Through Happy Hour podcast?
Listen to this damn show. Damn it.
The Napping Through Happy Hour podcast, brought to you by Geekscape.
Real life, real drama, real time.
I'm Gary Sinise.
That's the ad. That's the ad.
Hi, friends. The world got you down. Don't be sad. Listen to $2 Late Fee with Zach and Dustin.
$2 Late Fee is the podcast that celebrates the best decade of entertainment, the 1980s. We pick a movie and soundtrack from our youth that we loved and see if it holds up today. We also interview your favorite celebrities from that era.
All in the spirit of positivity and togetherness. Check us out at $2LateFee.com.
Kyle, I think you literally just made me tack on something to my what did I watch this week just by mentioning that. So but unless we have anything else to say.
No, this movie is so good, and I'm really actually quite glad that I waited 10 years to watch it. Ironically,
because you got to enjoy it without everyone being like, isn't it so good? Like, when
Everybody told me that it was so good on, like, Reddit Horror, and I was like, fuck that.
Well, Reddit Horror was always because Reddit Horror, especially in 2014, was the source of bad takes.
I'm very glad though that this just kind of clicked, and this was a perfect viewing experience for me.
There we go. Well, Scott, I know it was a perfect viewing experience, but let's say you wanted to make it even more perfect. What would your double feature be?
So we've been talking a lot about Kid Logic. I'm going to go with arguably my all-time favorite horror movie, Nightmare on Elm Street, because it's this. It's basically what they're doing. It's the kids save the day. They booby trap a house. They try and kill this entity that will keep coming after you no matter what you do. And it's like it would be a really good night. I think I would start with It Follows, and then I would end with Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right. Well, I'm going to jump in here because I'm going to pick a different teen horror film that's final set piece takes place in the school pool that I think is a little bit more fun, The Faculty.
Killer grown-ups. I'm fine with that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And Kyle?
Before I do that, I just want to give a quick shout-out to Horrors of Love did a It Follows episode, which is very fun. So if you want to dig even deeper to It Follows, Horrors of Love did an episode on it, which I loved last year. But I'm actually going just on music alone, which actually Scott already referenced. I'm going to go Maniac, the remake. Tonally, completely different, but like, you know, same time
period.
Like, but
cinematically there.
I think that like you're gonna have two different experiences with like at least like one sensory experience being similar, you know. So I think it could be a fun double feature.
And right. I love Maniac 2012. Mm. It is,
yeah.
I mean, it's so outside of my regular wheelhouse because there's so much brutality against women.
Yeah,
and that's I truly, truly dislike the original, but man. Maniac 2012. I mean, we did it on this show. I went on Jersey Ghouls and discussed it.
We did it on Red Heart Club. We've never done Maniac.
We haven't done it on here.
12 on here. No. I know. So you can,
guys,
you can still make that happen. But
I don't think that anybody wants me to talk about that movie ever again, though. I mean, they've heard me talk about it enough.
We're here. We're here for you to live your best life. And
thanks, buddy.
You know, we always love to know what you've got going on. So let's talk about the What's Going On segment. Nothing too crazy, just hey, get your tickets for Creature Feature Weekend, April 19th to the 21st, on the day that we're recording this. We just found out that Tommy Lee Wallace will be one of the guests, so hell yeah, he's practically horror movie night royalty. And go check out some of our bonus conversations. Go to the Patreon, patreon.com/HMNpodcast. And lastly, visit our website, hmnpodcast.com. Buy yourself a t-shirt, buy yourself some swag, show everybody how much you love our show, or get compliments on how funny your shirt is. Who knows? But now, the final segment of the show, what did you watch, read, etc.? Man, we need to catch your name, but that's fine. Scott, this was your pick.
What did you do?
Yeah, what did you do?
You don't want to know what I did. It's so funny that you mentioned True Detective, because Megan was like, do you want to watch True Detective? I was like, no, actually, I don't. There have been three seasons, and I do not want to watch four seasons of a TV show.
Well, it's an anthology show, so you can just jump into any season.
And that's what we are doing. We started with season four, and we just finished the first episode last night. The thing about True Detective that I am really on the fence about is the pacing. I mean, first of all, the pacing, because it's TV pacing, which is hard for me. But they're also, they breadcrumb you a lot with, I mean, it's a detective show. It's a procedural at its heart. But there's spooky shit. And no one tell me otherwise one way or the other. I'm not asking for any input. I'm just saying that the frustrating thing is I don't know if there's any spooky shit actually happening, or if there's or if it's like an Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot type thing where it's like, not actually supernatural. I'm guessing it's not actually supernatural. But the season is really fucking cool so far. So
cool.
Nice.
Have you guys started watching it at all?
I've never watched a single second of True Detective.
I couldn't have said that until yesterday.
Yeah,
you guys.
I probably will. I think everyone has told me that season four is off to a good start. Season one is like must-watch TV.
And
season
you love
two
TV.
And three is for your discretion. Like some people love seasons two and three, and some people are... Yeah, undecided on it.
Season one, just with the stuff that you're wrestling with, Scott, and the stuff that you would like, Matt, it's worth watching.
I know it's one of the ones I have to watch. So talking about my love of TV, and you mentioning the Zafty brothers, mm-hmm. I don't know how I feel about The Curse, the show that they did with Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone, but I will say that I have not stopped thinking of the final shot of the final episode of The Curse for over a week and a half now. And I like keep just finding myself listening to like discourse on like what does the ending mean, like what is the show about. And The Curse is like a very strange show. I think that people are mostly going to hate it, and then there'll be like in 10 years like a huge reevaluation of it ultimately. Yeah. But the very softball pitch of this show is that Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone play two white people living in a living on land that was originally Native American land, and they're trying to do a house flipping show in this area while also trying to respect the local heritage, and ultimately come off like very false white saviors to everybody in the community. And they just keep digging themselves into a deeper hole. But simultaneously, Nathan Fielder, in an attempt to film a scene to make him seem more likable, pisses off a local and gets a curse put on him. And he is convinced that everything bad that's happening to him is because of the curse, while we, the audience, are like, no, you're just a bad person who's making bad decisions throughout the whole show. And then it takes a really crazy twist in the final episode, which I won't talk about on here, but if Scott and Kyle wanted to save themselves the time after recording, I'm happy to tell them how it ends. But don't know if I can hard recommend that, but what I can hard recommend is a movie that I think was snubbed at the Oscar announcements on the day that we're recording this, at least in the animated feature category. I finally watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, and it is so much fun. Ooh. It is so charming. It is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie I was making with the toys in my basement as a child, where it's literally just like, A, you've got the all four of the turtles are voiced by actual teenagers. It's just like they got a bunch of 12 and 13 year old kids and let them completely improvise and have fun with the dialogue, so it feels very loose and free. And then they've got everybody in there. They don't have Baxter Fly, which is weird. They have a character named Superfly instead, who's clearly Baxter Fly, which bothered me. But they
didn't sign off the rights on Baxter Fly.
I know, but they got like
who did this?
Who owns the rights to Baxter Fly?
Yeah, they got Mondo Gecko is in there. I think like Mutant Gin Man, I think, shows up at one point. But it's like any nice. Like animal mutant from the history of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is in this movie, because the essential plot is that the slime that made the turtles and the splinter also hit a bunch of other animals at the same time, but all of these other animals didn't have a splinter teaching them to be good. So you've got this whole group of evil mutants that see the turtles as their brothers and are trying to coerce them to the dark side. But it's so fun. It's so loose. It's so fast. 10 out of 10, high recommend. I think I put it as like my number 3 or number 4 favorite film of 2023.
Wow.
And I thought it was at least going to get an animation award, but I don't know. It's a weird year. There's a lot of great animated films, but Miyazaki came out of retirement after 20 years. So like, he's just getting all the awards now. Mm-hmm. So it's a real bummer for any other animated film in 2023. But Kyle, take us home.
Well, this segment's brought to you by Max, because I watched Love Has Won, which is the Cult of Mother God documentary, three-part documentary. And heard polarizing reviews, so here's my two cents. I thought it was interesting. I mean, I think that the case itself is really interesting. The fact that the cult is still active and exists is really interesting, and a lot of them are part of the documentary. But also they are a cult that's built upon a little bit of commercialization, so I think that like that helps in their favor.
In their mind, but it's like no press is bad press, basically.
Right. I mean, and that, you know, the whole idea of Love Is One, or what it eventually becomes Love Is One, is that they live stream every day. Like, they are active, and like so there's a lot of evidence and footage and segments of that are involved. But it's also like the story of it kind of makes a lot of sense. You know, like the if you could sort of put, it's almost like a Mad Libs a little bit. Like it just, you know, this woman abandons her children and she starts a cult all about love. And then she takes she makes an excuse for her excess, and her mental health issues evolve more because of the excess in what she's taking excess in. And a whole bunch of people think that that's lovely. You know, it's like, I really enjoyed watching it. I would say that if you have trouble watching a person in actual physical and mental decline, that's something to take note of when you're watching it, or take note of in yourself when you watch it, because I mean, it starts out with the body cam footage of them going into the compound and finding her body. So like, and we see her body. So like, that's a great way to kick things off. But it's a really, I don't know. It's a really interesting doc. I think that there's a couple more things they could have done better, but it's three parts, and it's a great overview of that cult and of that story.
All right. Well, we'll have a funnier episode next week.
just make sure that you go to our socials and follow.
yeah. Don't forget to follow us, and we will be back next week with even more Horror Movie Night.
Obsessed with things that happened before your time? Well, if you are, join me, the host of Before My Time, Gelsey Lorie, to discuss the wonders of the yesteryears that we weren't around to enjoy ourselves. You can find us on all podcast platforms.
Soon you'll be swaying, so come on, sing along.
We're making an ad.
Napping ad.
This is where I think if we're doing it right, Alec Baldwin comes in. He says a couple things. Mm-hmm. He listens to the podcast every week. Yep. Has he been canceled? Wait, is Alec Baldwin the one who killed somebody? I hear that Gary Sinise is free.
Oh, okay, great.
He hasn't worked since 2020.
So what would be the script that we would have Gary Sinise say for the Napping Through Happy Hour podcast?
Listen to this damn show. Damn it.
The Napping Through Happy Hour podcast brought to you by Geekscape.
Real life, real drama, real time.
I'm Gary Sinise.
That's the ad.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.